Ben Moore has been in love with bees for as long as anyone can remember. And as far as we can tell, the feeling is entirely mutual. Although he still sometimes feels the sting of his passion. Hang around, learn a little. It's as sweet as honey and always a buzz. It's the Ultimate Pollinators Podcast with Ben, his friends and associates, and of course, Ben's bees.
Hey everyone, Bees with Ben. Have I got an awesome cracking episode on this week? I have the Randy Oliver. So Randy's a beekeeper from California, runs over about 1,000 hives, and is the guru of all gurus. Been keeping bees since the 1960s. He's a bee biologist and an absolute wealth of information. If there's a Appomondia or if there's a big conference somewhere around the world, Randy is the keynote speaker, and he always gets a big crowd watching him talk because he's a fantastic speaker. Super excited for this episode and really, really keen to have him on. It was actually interesting because working out the times, I'll let you folk work this out, but I had to record this with Randy at 8 a.m. Californian time. So you work out the maths of what time I had to record this, but it's absolutely a privilege and an honor to have Randy on the podcast. Hey, Randy, thank you so much for your time. I'm super excited to have you on. So how's your morning looking, Randy?
Well, it's pretty crazy. This is almond pollination season for us, so we're opposite you guys. And I just helping my son out with an emergency trip to the auto shop for the trucks. So the hives are all in almonds, but he's saying it's the worst colony quality that he's ever experienced. And he grew up, both of my sons grew up riding in car seats next to me driving to the almonds.
Okay.
So their entire life has been going to the almonds. And he says the bees are the worst they've ever looked at. And he's not quite sure why. They looked okay in the autumn. We had a real bad drought and dearth due to that, but we had fed pollen stub and the colonies looked okay. But this winter they went downhill. We had a snow event that was rough for them, but across the board. So as we were driving back home here just a few minutes ago, I was asking him, well, what do you think it could possibly be? What variables have been there that have changed anything? And I said, you've got this extended-release oxalic acid treatment in them. And even though some research we just did completed indicated that it did not have an adverse effect on colonies, he said, you know, this is actually the second year we've treated over winter with that. So
okay.
He didn't think it was that. So we're not quite sure. You know, you can keep bees all your life. In some years, you can't explain, you know, just what's happening. They're going down there every day and having to swap frames around and boost colonies and to try to make our contract strength, which is normally a very minor thing that we do, but this year it's a major thing. So there are unanswered questions,
That's interesting, Randy. So is it just not the colonies aren't as big as years gone by? So
right.
You don't have those numbers?
We get paid, we get graded per cluster size,
okay.
Cluster grading. And we get paid according to that. And some of our contracts, we need to have an 8-frame average. Some we get bonuses for clear up to 10-frame. And we have a history of bringing in very good bees year after year, you know, exceeding our strength requirements. But this year is not happening.
That's interesting. And what's, if you don't mind me asking, what's the average price you get paid per hive to have on the almonds in California, Randy?
Well, in U.S. dollars, the average right now is about maybe $190.
Okay.
But we go for premium contracts. So our better contracts, we're making $230
okay.
a hive. So, and this is, you know, insane because a few years ago, I was riding with one of my sons. He was in his 30s at that time, and we pulled up to an orchard to drop off a load of bees. And I said, Ian, do you realize that we've been driving the same truck since you were in a car seat as a baby on the front seat through this exact same drop in this same orchard? And we used to do it for $700 per load.
Wow.
He said, well, how much are we making for the same load right today? And I said, $11,000. In the same truck, the same orchard, the same drop, in his lifespan, we went from making $700 for a load of bees to $11,000.
Wow.
Nowadays, that same orchard, we still go back to that same drop, we're probably around $15,000 or so. So that incredible change over one's lifetime of the, your income, it changes your entire business model. So for all of us California beekeepers, virtually all of us are dependent upon almond pollination, but we only supply, I think something like maybe 80% of the hives necessary for almond pollination. The rest have to be trucked in from other states, clear across the country to California just to supply the demand for almond pollination.
That's interesting, Randy. And so after the almond pollination, so talk us through what happens next, where you take your bees, you know, what flows you sort of work on and for the rest of the year.
Yeah, well, then we all diverge, the different beekeepers. So those that need to, after the almonds are done blooming, there's nothing for the bees to eat in those orchards. So they start spraying fungicides and some insecticides too. So they got to get your bees out of there. Well, those that came from other parts of the country, it's still under snow then. So they don't want to take their bees back to snow. So they typically will then rotate to either going down to Texas, the southern states, or up along the west coast, up further north for apple and pear pollination there, before they can move them back to the colder states in the Midwest where there's more water and they take them for the summer. Now, we California beekeepers are a bit different. Even though many California beekeepers also move their bees out of California during the summer when it dries up in California, some of us stay here. But we have the advantage is that we can supply queen bees and package bees because of our earlier buildup than the other states. So California is a huge producer of queen bees and package bees that are then shipped to other states and nucleus colonies. And that's what we, in my own operation over the years, I looked at, in a beekeeping business, and people say, well, what should I do? I said, well, first, find something that you enjoy doing. And second, that something that you can do well. And third, that is profitable for you.
Yes.
Okay. If you don't enjoy doing it, why do it? You need to have some skills and it should be profitable. And what I realized many, many years ago is that we don't live in a very good honey producing area. I mean, we can make honey, but not enough to, crop wise, 35 pounds is an average crop. We may make 50 pounds per colony, but nothing like most Australian beekeepers make. And even the Midwestern beekeepers, where your typical honey crop is 100 to 200 pounds. Well, you can make a living with that kind of honey crop, but we don't make enough honey to make a living on. What we could do is make a living on selling bees. So what I found years ago that if we took very strong, high-quality hives to almond pollination at a premium, we did well. That did not quite cover operating costs, but really was a good, solid income. Then if we bring our hives back and split them and sell nucleus colonies to other beekeepers, we would actually then be in the black, and any honey we made would then be profit in the rest of the year. But the beauty of this is that almonds start blooming the middle of February for us, and we have all of our nucs sold by the end of April. So we've got February, March, April, 3 months. We make 95% of our income in 3 months. And then we're not even dependent upon making a honey crop. We just essentially just kind of kick back and let the bees take care of themselves for the rest of the year. So that was a really nice model that worked for a number of years. And then Varroa came, and Varroa, of course, changes bee management a lot. what we were doing is moving our bees out of state to irrigate at Lucerne. And so we could split our colonies right after almonds into five frame nucs, use our local nectar and pollen flow, not to make a honey crop, but to simply build them up to strong singles. We could then take a strong single in early summer, July, our months. You guys have to switch your months by 6 months to understand what I'm talking about.
Yes.
But by just after the summer solstice, the second cutting bloom of lucerne would be coming on. We could take a strong 10-frame single there, put 10-frame deep of foundation on top of it, because we need to draw. We sell 1,000 nucleus colonies a year, so we need to draw 5,000 frames of foundation.
Yes.
So our business model is we buy a preassembled frame with foundation in it for $2.
Okay.
A year later, we sell it in a nuc for $30. That's a $30 margin per frame. Okay. And they have to have bees covering them and be drawn out and have honey and fruit in them. But basically, our business is to take a $2 frame and turn it into a $30 frame over the course of a year. So that's our business model. So what we could do is we could take singles up to the lucerne, put a 10 frames of foundation over that single, and 10 days later, it would be solid wall to wall, drawn out and filled with honey and capped over. So, and then the colonies would be set up for the rest of the year. There's nothing else that you had to do. Now, before Varroa, you guys still don't realize what it's like.
No, exactly. Tell us about Varroa. Tell us all about it, how bad it is.
Yeah, the good old days. We all look forward to those good old days. So anyway, and that was a really easy model when I ran the business by myself, that I could run down to almond pollination, I could bring back the hives and split them, sell the nucs, let them build up on our local flow, and take them up to Lucerne and have my draw out those 10 frames and fill the honey by early summer, and life is pretty easy. You could just leave them up there and coast for the rest of the season. Didn't even have to bother with the colonies. Just pick up by fall and bring them back home. Varroa made it more difficult. You can't just leave them sit up there without managing them. So then what we changed with is our colonies here in where I live in the foothills in California. It's very dry during the summer, and there's no pollen flow for midsummer on to fall. So the bees would go downhill. They would not be in shape for almond pollination. So we needed to have them moved out of state in order to get a fall pollen flow. In the lucerne fields, they would get a fall pollen flow, and they would come back. There's a plant called rabbit brush that puts a nice pollen flow on in the fall. And that allowed us, that would get our colonies ready for almond pollination. And then before it got too cold up there in the state of Nevada, we would move them back home for overwintering, and they'd be all set up. So it was a really easy situation for us. When Varroa arrived, it made that summer management with your bees away from home much more difficult. So I started experimenting with feeding pollen sub instead, and we found out, hey, we could leave the bees at home. And instead of letting nature feed them, we could take care of them at home, and we could feed them with the pollen sub. And we dialed that in and learned how to use pollen sub effectively. And that's why I have so much interest in pollen sub and do so much research on pollen sub, trying to improve the pollen subs because we're so dependent upon that. Hey, now, as an aside, let me just tell you something. One of the things we're doing as far as Varroa and these bees my conversation with my son this morning about figuring out what could be the problem. We're doing we've been doing an experimental treatment using oxalic acid dissolved in glycerin on a cellulose sponge in order to control Varroa.
Okay.
And so I knew they had run in our operation cellulose sponges over the winter here. And I had just completed the data from a controlled trial where we treated half the colonies with cellulose sponges and half not in the same yard to see if there was any adverse effect of running it over the winter, because it's an organic treatment and very inexpensive and very efficacious. And it showed maybe the slightest effect, not significantly significant, but we didn't see a problem. but I asked my son, be aware of this. Could it possibly be, you know, looking at the possible variables, why our bees look worse this year? He said, well, you know, we ran the sponges last year too, and the colonies were okay. But here's what I asked him. I said, in our operation right now, we're doing a very strong selective breeding program for bees that exhibit resistance to the varroa mite.
Okay.
And we have colonies that need no varroa mite treatment whatsoever. They completely control varroa by themselves. We started out 5 years ago with less than just a fraction of a percent of colonies that exhibited that trait. But out of 1,500 hives every year, we select about 25 of the best to breed from. So strong selective pressure. The only colonies we breed from, and we queen every colony in our operation every spring, is only from colonies that exhibit strong resistance to varroa. The issue is the heritability is almost nothing so far. We haven't locked that trait into a female bloodline yet. So you can have a colony that gets mite counts of zero, varroa zero, month after month for an entire year, completely resistant to a mite.
Wow. Okay.
But you breed daughters from that queen, and only a small percentage of those colonies show that resistance. It's not easily heritable. We haven't locked the critical genes into a female bloodline yet, although this may we may be doing it this year. I get goosebumps even saying this because we got one queen line that's looking really good. But back to this, right now we've got about 14% of our colonies are marked that have never needed a treatment over the last year. That are showing strong resistance. So we've gone from a fraction of 1% up to 14% this year. So it's slow progress. That's after 5 years of intense selective breeding. But they're a control group because they don't get any treatment. So I said, Eric, have you compared the strength of the untreated breeders to the treated other colonies just to confirm that it's not the treatment? He goes, oh yeah, they're all over the place too. He doesn't see a consistent effect. But here's the point. One of the things that you're going to hear when and again, I know you Australians are aware of varroa and aware of how devastating, how it's going to change your life beyond what you can even imagine as beekeepers. Most when it hits Australia, assume that half your beekeepers are going to go out of business.
That's incredible.
Okay, it's going to be a really big thing. And as I said years ago, speaking in Australia, I said, guys, keep your biosecurity up. You just keep it out of the country until we can breed mite-resistant bees. When we finally breed mite-resistant bees, then you'll be able to avoid a lot of that. You can just change your laws and import some bee stock that's resistant. Unfortunately, it's taking a long time
for us to develop
these mite-resistant bees. But I can tell you right now, there's not a problem with it. Now, you're going to hear people say, oh, well, for mite-resistant bees, they're going to have to be spicy bees, or they're not going to be productive bees. It's going to be trade-offs. Let me just put that illusion to rest right now. There's no justification for that. Our mite-resistant colonies are as gentle as pussycats. We work with no veil, no gloves, and shorts and t-shirts with them all summer long. They're non-stinging bees, and they can be very, very good honey producers. They can be often the strongest, most productive colonies in the yard. We don't see any negative trade-off for breeding for mite resistance.
Okay, that's interesting.
If there is, it's made up by the fact that because they don't have mites and don't have viruses, they perform better. So there's no... We don't see any downside to breeding for mite resistance, which is a really good, just for your crystal ball to tell you guys, you know, for your future, that's a really good thing. It means you can still have gentle, productive bees and have them resistant to varroa mite.
Wow, that's so interesting, Randy. Absolutely incredible. What about, let's rewind the clock back sort of over a decade now, CCD, colony collapse disorder. Now, what effect did that have on you and your business? And also... the hobbyist beekeeper, you know, was there not as much intake as people keeping bees, or was there more people wanting to keep bees? So tell us about that.
Okay, so first thing, don't believe anything you read in the media.
Yes.
It's all wrong.
Okay. That's true. Yep.
Okay. What was called CCD back then is not what it people use that term for now. CCD back then was coincident with the invasion of Nazima Sirani into North America. Nazima Sirani started to invade around the year 2001, and the invasion was complete by about 2008. By that time, any colonies that were highly susceptible to Nazima Sirani and associated viruses were all bred out. They were all dead. As somebody said, is anybody breeding for CCD resistance? And I said, well, I don't know of any breeders who are breeding from dead colonies. So yes, we are, by default, we are breeding for CCD resistance, which was essentially Nosema Sirani and virus resistance. Okay. So you could just track it specifically. And here's the thing, CCD, the field signs, the sudden disappearance of the adult bees while they're still brooding the hive, there's only one pathogen that causes that field sign, and that's Nosema.
Okay.
There's no other pathogen that causes that. And it, to me, as a biologist, it was so obvious because I was tracking very closely Nosema Sirani, tracking viruses. I was working with an Israeli startup of molecular biologists. We're the only trial any researchers that ever created in situ, intentionally created CCD in a test group in a large field trial.
Interesting. Wow. So, okay.
Yeah. And we did that by inoculating the colonies with a strain of a Israeli acute paralysis virus that, in combination with Nosema Sirani, would just devastate, knock out these colonies. Okay, now since then, since about 2010, we stopped seeing that sign. Nobody reports that sudden disappearance of the bees with brood in the hive now. Now, what they call CCD is Varroa.
Okay. Okay.
It's poor Varroa management. The other term is used is PPB, and that stands for piss poor beekeeping.
That's interesting.
Those beekeepers who, for one reason or whatever, don't properly manage the Varroa, yeah, they still have large losses. They can blame it on whatever they want other than themselves, but it's almost invariably inadequate Varroa management. Now, the media gets a hold of this, and any group that is anti-anything, they took our honeybees and used them as their poster child. So if you were anti-pesticide, if you were anti-windmills, anti-cell phones, anti-UFOs, anti-genetically engineered crops, you name it, they blamed CCD on their bugaboo, okay? And it's Varroa came in. And it isn't Varroa that kills the colonies. It's the deforming virus that's associated with Varroa in most countries. Some countries, some of the other viruses, some of the paralytic viruses are the combination. And in New Zealand, that was what was happening.
Interesting.
So there's a constant evolution of these viruses. And just like the Omicron variant, you get the same thing with chalk brood. You get the same thing with European fowl brood. You get the same thing with Varroa and deformed wing virus. We just had deforming virus A replaced by deforming virus B here in both Europe and in North America. So these virus variants that everybody's talking about with Omicron and coronavirus, we're used to this with the pathogens in our honeybees, and this is always going to continue. It's called the Red Queen hypothesis. It means you have to keep running all the time just to stay in place in competition with the pathogens. So as a biologist, I watch this evolution. I've been keeping bees 55 years. I've seen this evolution of between the bees and their pathogens over and over again with the invasion of each new one. When we got chalk brood, when we got tracheal mite, when we got Varroa mite, when we have the change with the deformed wing virus, when Nosema Sirani invaded. Every one of those invasions of new pathogen, it's the same thing. It's a plague that just wipes out a bunch of our bees. And it's the first one that made the media was with Varroa. I mean, when tracheal mite invaded North America, we lost 70% of our hives in California.
Wow, that's incredible.
And that didn't make the media at all. Nobody knew about that. But because now the media gets on here and and this save the honeybee. Okay. Well, if you become a beekeeper, you're going to help to save the honeybee. Yes. It's just absolute nonsense. The last reason in the world anybody should ever become a beekeeper is trying to save the honeybee. Honeybee does not need saving. It's an industrially managed livestock. There is not in any danger whatsoever in going extinct other than races in their native countries in Europe. But it's an introduced species in Australia. It's an introduced species in the United States. You don't need to save an introduced species, and they're in no threat of disappearance whatsoever because the virtually every colony is a managed colony by commercial beekeepers. But the hobbyists got this message, and they want to go out and save the honeybee, do what they think is the right thing by getting a colony of bees. Well, I'll tell you right now, getting a colony of bees and not managing correctly and creating a varroa factory that just spreads varroa mites to everybody else around does not help the situation in any way. So all these well-meaning hobby beekeepers who want to be treatment-free and save the honeybee are actually doing us a disfavor.
That's
interesting. It makes it much more difficult for us to keep bees. And so CCD, the excuse them when their colonies die, they swarmed. Oh, they absconded. Oh, they ascended to the heavens somewhere. Anything yes. other than that, they didn't manage varroa and the colonies collapsed from varroa and viruses.
That's interesting.
But here's the thing. Back to your original question, how has CCD affected? It's the most profitable thing to the supply warehouses that's ever happened. They've made money hand over fist. Varroa is the best thing that ever happened to the bee equipment suppliers because of this incredible demand by the hobby industry to buy beekeeping equipment. So they are just loving it, raking in the money, selling to all these hobbyists.
How interesting is that? That's incredible, Randy. That's really, really interesting. So what about knowing what you know now, and you could go back, 20, 30, 40 years.
I'd be in Australia.
Oh, you'd be in Australia, okay? Yes. Just because of no varroa
mites. You guys are living in the past, okay? Or alternatively, we are your crystal ball for the future.
Yeah, that's interesting, and that's so true. And it's interesting for the listeners to hear that varroa mite is, it is a pain in that absolute proverbial. It is absolutely a terrible little mite. What's the biggest changes? Obviously, been keeping bees since the 1960s. Is that right, Randy?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what's the biggest changes you've sort of seen in the industry? Varroa mite aside,
it's more profitable. It's the most profitable beekeeping has ever been.
Okay. Yes.
Here's the thing. In any business whatsoever, if that business is really stressed and having big difficulties, that's when you can make the most profit.
Okay.
Because if you got the leg up on anybody else, you can make profit. So what's happened is I started running to almond pollination at about $10 per colony for rent. I remember hitting $18 a colony and thinking I died and gone to heaven. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
We're making $230 a hive going to the same orchards now.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay. So the profitability is incredibly different. We used to sell nukes for $29. That was for many years. $29 was a 5-frame nuke. That's what you pay for it. We're making $175 wholesale, and they're getting sold for $225
wow.
now.
Okay.
Okay, this is in a relatively short time span. So you're asking, look back, 30 years. I'm telling you, in that 30 years time span, that's what's happened. It's made for the good beekeeper. This is the most profitable beekeeping has ever been because of mainly the demand for almond pollination, and even in other crops, the price that beekeepers are making now for other crops is much, much better. As we humans destroy the environment and make it more difficult, and climate change is hurting the native pollinators, the honeybee becomes more and more important as an agricultural pollinator. So that's a very good industry. If we can ever deal with the Chinese imports so that people aren't buying rice syrup and paying for the price of honey by buying rice syrup, the demand for honey is going up because of natural. And so, you know, we can never even begin to fulfill the demand that we have for our honey crop. I mean, we sell every drop of honey we can possibly sell. When a few years ago, when I was getting ready to hand over my beekeeping business to my sons, I said, here's an opportunity, guys. Here's a business where you have people knocking on the door for every one of your products and services that you never have to advertise. You're going to sell in advance everything you possibly have.
Yes,
I said, that's not a bad business.
It is, isn't it? That's awesome.
to take over. And so that's what they're doing. I said, it's a lot, you're a beekeeper. You know, beekeeping is a lot of hard work. You're totally dependent upon the environment. And in California, what I'm hearing also from Australia to some extent, climate change is hitting us harder than most of our country. We are really experiencing climate change. The erraticness of the climate in the last, since Christmas time, we got a record freezing snowstorm.
Really?
And now we're at record heat. And I just got an email from a friend in Southern California that they have a massive wildfire going in the middle of winter, started yesterday with winds in Southern California. We're having these. So in this last year, my sons went through beekeeping with tremendous, terrible drought dearth and fires that we had to, wildfires. We had to move the hives out. We lost some hives.
Really?
Wildfire.
Okay. Wow.
Okay, so because being so dry, no pollen, and then having an extreme, and then in fall, we got an atmospheric river that came in and dumped 15 inches of rain on us over in one day, washed away 50 hives in a flood where you couldn't even see the stream from where we weren't even aware of a stream being near the apiary, but this huge flooding. And then we get drought following that. And then the bees start building up really early because we have this exceptionally warm winter time. And then at Christmas time, we get this icy cold storm come in and just hit them at spring turnover and just slam our colonies bad. And then because it's warm, the bears had not gone into hibernation.
Oh, wow.
Which means our electric fences keep the bears out of our bee yards. The bears, when they walk on the snow, their feet aren't grounded, so the electric fences don't touch them. So before we can even get through the snow to access to our yards, the bears wiped out two of our apiaries.
No way. Wow.
And then now then almonds are coming in on early because that freezing snow melted. We're having exceptionally early spring. It feels like summer weather right now. The almonds are going to start blooming early, and we're in wildfire season already. So yesterday I did controlled burning. We have from that snowstorm, it knocked down tens of thousands of trees. This snow right after Christmas, 2 days after Christmas, brought our county to its knees. We were out of power for 2 weeks. We were out of internet service for a month. They're still clearing the roads, massive scale, with all the trees. You couldn't drive a quarter mile on any road in our county from all the trees falling down from this once every 50 years snowfall. Okay. So yesterday I used a chainsaw and burned all day long trying to get ahead of burn season while we're still allowed to burn, just to clear all the broken trees off of our property. When I hang up with you, we're going to spend the whole rest of the day chainsawing and burning, because we're not going to be able to burn here by permit soon because it's going to be too much fire danger. So this is the life that we're living now with climate change and with our bees. We're learning how to do things. And so pollen sub and learning how to feed bees optimally is becoming more and more critical to us because nature is not friendly anymore.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that's incredible.
Oh, hang on. I must have muted you here. What did I do?
Not sure. Can you hear me?
No, I can hear you. I must have touched a button.
All good. I know you got a busy day ahead of you, but I've got two more questions for you, Randy. I really appreciate your time. Question, of all the scientific research you've done, which one did you find the most interesting?
Oh, wow. Oh, that's a, God, so much, so fascinating. And, yeah, just learning so much. Right now, the pollen sub-trial that I recently finished up, because that went so far beyond. I wound up writing off this pollen sub-trial, which normally would be a one-article write-up. I published 10 separate articles in the American Bee Journal of what we learned on that. And I'm following up now. There will be even more follow-up based upon what I learned from that one trial. And
interesting.
It was supposed to just be a consumer reports, a comparative test of the pollen subs that are on the market. But then, because we went a little bit deeper, I collaborated with another researcher, and we did full analysis of all these subs, and also got some molecular work done. I could look deeper and not only say one performed better than the other, but figure out why. Why do some subs outperform others? And the fascinating thing was, it looks like it went to the essential amino acid balance.
Oh, okay.
And our state of the art of the under, and I know Doug Somerville, and
yes.
huge admiration for him and his fat bees, skinny bees, and all that he's learned from that. But you got to realize our state of the art of our knowledge of essential amino acids for honeybees was published in 1953.
Wow. Okay.
1953. Our industry has not progressed. Every other livestock industry, that was the starting point, amino acid understanding. And every other livestock industry has formulated diets where they understand that you change, if you're growing chicks or pigs, you change the essential amino acid ratio in each ration for the age of the organism. We're still stuck at the very beginning, 1953. So I did a deep dive in that paper by the Groot back in 1953, 70-page paper, and saw where he was very cautious about his findings. He was a meticulous researcher, but he brought up points that need to be looked at. And I looked at those and reinterpreted his data, and looks like he made an error on which amino acid he normalized the other ones to, by normalizing your ratios to leucine, which is the predominant essential amino acid. It gives you a whole different picture of how you should formulate pollen subs. So this year, some of the manufacturers are going to be, I created an online calculator, anybody can use it, to test your pollen subs either by your formula, by what products or components you're putting into them, or by analysis, and then buy off the shelf essential amino acids, which are cheap, the concentrates, and balance it perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this is the option now that our manufacturers do. In 1 year, they may be able to do a huge improvement on all their subs. So my guess is there's going to be some controlled trials happening this summer for improved pollen subs, because I'll tell you right now, one of the subs that tested very well in our trial, my son went down and this year when we were feeding our colonies, he said, God, Dad, the sub that we've been using for the last 10 years, maybe we should try this other one that tested so well. So he went down to pick some up, and when he was picking it up from the supply house, he said, Eric Oliver, he said, are you Randy Oliver's son? And he says, yeah. And he goes, your article has just has driven a demand for our product to the roof. You know, that other beekeepers are reading this and they're saying, wow, have you changed our sales of our product right here? So the manufacturers pay attention to this research. And so in answer to your question, this one may be one of the most relevant to our industry and exciting to tease out the those findings.
Interesting. What for the list?
And now, let me say just one thing. Now, what I'm still working on is, it's not just the formula; it's how you feed it and where precisely you place it in the hive, and that's what I'm working on now. That you need to understand, to really do it right, you need to understand bee behavior, and you need to understand that the queen doesn't call the shots in the colony; the nurse bees call all the shots in the colony.
Interesting. Yes.
The nurse bees live in total darkness. They only fly out to poop a few times.
Yes.
They live in total darkness. Their whole world is cues, olfactory cues, our taste cues in the combs. So where the incoming pollen and the incoming nectar is placed in the hive, those are the cues that trigger the behaviors of the nurse bees, who then decide whether they're going to consume the eggs as fast as the queen lays them, which is called brood trimming. And during times of dearth, they just eat the eggs as fast as the queen lays them. Or whether instead they're going to produce jelly and feed them. That's based upon cues from where the pollen and the nectar are placed within the brood nest, not on the top bars, but within the brood nest. And so that's the research that I'm interested in now, because what I found is during our extreme drought and dry weather, simply putting the patties on the in between the brood chambers and feeding sugar syrup doesn't give the nurses the cues to build up the colonies. There's tricks to building up the colonies better. So that's the research I'm interested in now.
Wow. I'm looking forward to reading that. But for the listeners, because they're mostly in Australia, your articles are in the Australian Beekeeping Journal, the ABK. So anyone interested to actually read those, which are absolutely awesome, the last couple of editions of the Australian Beekeeping Journal. Now, before you get on to your day, Randy, obviously you got to...
Well, you know, and also mention the website. I mean, you want to read them immediately, directly, on scientificbeekeeping.com.
Yes, and what I'll do is...
Scientificbeekeeping.com.
And what I'll do is that'll go in the show notes. So anyone wanting to read that, for sure. And last question, Randy, before you go. Now, when you're not working with bees, what's your hobby? What do you do in your downtime?
God, I wish I had downtime. on a typical day, I wake up 4:35 in the morning and I get on Excel and crank data, do email and stuff until it's daylight, that I can get out there. I do have a large orchard, a large garden, a whole bunch of fruit trees. I enjoy hiking. I enjoy, I have a couple of some aquaria, but mainly I've really shifted to mainly just in my, I'm 71 years old now.
Sound young.
I have
young.
I have so many questions still to answer regarding beekeeping. So that really is my main fascination.
That's awesome. Absolutely, absolutely love it. Randy, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on this podcast. Really appreciate it. Maybe in a year's time, if I can get you back again, because we want to hear more about the research regarding the pollen supplement.
Keep that, Ben.
And I look forward to seeing you. Hopefully, are you going off to Appomondia in Russia?
No, you know what? One thing about the, because I'm a popular speaker, I was spending sometimes half of every month away from home.
Yes. Yeah.
That got too crazy. With Zoom now, I can, like I was keynote speaker for Australia and New Zealand in the same week. Okay, I can. So yes. And then it was like Peru before, and now I'm Scandinavia. With Zoom, I can stay home and still work and do my research, and I still share it. So as much as I miss the personal communication, I've gotten kind of spoiled of being able to focus on not having to be in airports and hotels.
Yes, all around the world. Yeah. No, that's
Randy,
we may or may not see you there, but we want to say a big, big thank you for your time. Absolutely amazing. And look forward to maybe, as I said, in a year's time, we'll get you back on if that's okay. That'd be absolutely awesome. Because I know it's busy.
You bet.
Yeah, you're about to go crazy, crazy busy with beekeeping season, because that's when it happens for us, start of almond pollination.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy busy right now, yes.
No, really appreciate your time. You take care. Look after yourself. And
Ben.
You take care. Really appreciate it, Randy. Really appreciate your time.
All right.
Take care. Sleep. Take care. Take care. All the best. Bye. Wow. How fantastic was that episode? I could have just talked to Randy for absolute ages. And so interesting. And how's that? Don't believe everything you see on the media. Talking about CCD, colony collapse disorder. Talking about Nosema serrana. That was interesting. Now, we hear the media, probably a little bit like this coronavirus. Yeah, I mean, the media sort of portrays it one way, but it's actually something else. So very, very interesting. It was brilliant having Randy on. Absolute fantastic. Really appreciate his time because obviously, you know, he's moving beast almonds. So he's absolutely under the pump. He's got his two sons helping him, but he's an absolutely busy man. And doesn't he sound young? 71 years of age. And he sounds super, super young and just full of enthusiasm and for that love of bees. So thank you for listening. And don't forget, if you want to hear someone on the podcast, shoot me your text message, 0437-077-92. A lot of people asked to have Randy on. So it was, took a little bit of time, but we got him on. So if you know of someone else you'd like to have on or a particular subject, I will endeavor and I'll make sure that happens. And thank you so much for listening. And until next week, take care, look after yourselves, and look after those bees.